My friends, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show for August 13th, 2005. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com, and also I write for antiwar.com. Everything you are about to hear has been confirmed by the Department of Justice's Office of the Inspector General. Our first guest today is the courageous former contract linguist for the FBI turned would-be whistleblower, Sybelle Edmonds. And I say would be because the Department of Justice has invoked the made-up state secrets privilege to prevent her from telling us the whole truth about what she learned while at the FBI and why the state is so intent on covering it up. A new article in Vanity Fair called An Inconvenient Patriot has broken new ground in her story. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show, Sybelle.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you for inviting me back on your show.
Well, it's very nice to talk with you always, and it's really kind of fun to try to question around the state secrets privilege.
Yeah, we'll try to have fun with that part.
Okay. So, tell us first of all, we know that you're a contract linguist, translator for the FBI. Which languages were you a specialist in?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me tell you that according to the Department of Justice, all my languages that I speak are considered top secret, classified, and state secret case,
Oh. Which
is ridiculous. That means that even my resume would be considered a top secret document. And you can go and find it in all the websites that cite my languages. So I speak Turkish, Farsi. This is the language that is being spoken in Iran. It's a Persian language. And Azerbaijani.
And for what length of time did you work for the FBI?
I worked for the Bureau for a little bit longer than 6 months, 6.5 months.
And that was from pretty much right after September 11th through the...
3 days after September 11th until March 22nd, 2002.
Okay. Now, we know already that there were problems with some of your colleagues in the translation department, which we will discuss in more detail later. But now, basically, the big story why I brought you back on the show is that finally, a reporter has come from across the ocean to dig into this story. And it seems like he's unearthed quite a bit from others in government who have had a chance to hear your whole story behind closed doors.
I'm so glad that you pointed out to the fact that David Rose came from England and spent 4 or 5 months on this story, while for three and a half years, nobody here, at least from the main press, has bothered to do so. And David worked diligently on this story, and he interviewed many officials from the FBI and from the Congress, and then basically put out this story, 11-page story. I'm very thankful to David and Vanity Fair to a degree.
It seems from reading the article that the reason that he was so successful in being able to dig up all these facts is because you actually have, from the very beginning, gone through all of the proper channels. You've told your story to all the people who should have had it told to them. And so basically what David Rose did was just sort of follow you around and got anonymous leaks from the people that you actually have been allowed to tell your story to in secret, right?
See, this is why I love interviews with you, Scott, because you are right on the facts. Great. You're absolutely correct, because I testified several times before various representative senators in 2002, summer 2002, and gave them my testimony. And as you know, two senators, Senator Grassley, Republican, and Senator Leahy, they came out 3 years ago, more than 3 years ago, publicly. They said that FBI, during their meetings with the Senate, confirmed all my allegations and denied none. And in fact, Senator Grassley said that she is very credible because even the FBI management have corroborated all her stories and all her reports. And he pointed out to the fact that he was going to turn the department upside down and get to the bottom of this issue. And here today, 3 years later, nobody has even touched it.
All right. Hold it right there, Sybelle. We'll be right back, everybody, with Sybelle Edmonds on the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format. I'm talking with Sabelle Edmonds. Her website is justacitizen.com, and if you go there, you can sign her petition begging the national government to finally lift the gag order and let this woman tell us the story that she has been trying to tell us for so many years now. And it's, you know, you do such a good job in these interviews, it's almost hard to tell that you have a gag order that forbids you from saying certain things.
Well, yes, because first of all, the gag orders that they have issued, I have several gag orders. In fact, based on the research that my attorney is ACLU conducted, I'm the most gagged person in the United States history, believe me or not, for someone who worked 6 months as a language specialist of the FBI. As you know, they gagged the Congress in May 2004. Department of Justice issued a gag order and ordered the senators to pull out everything from their websites and not to comment anything that had to do with my case. And the Inspector General's report was gagged and completely classified. They issued the state secret privilege for the second time when the 9/11 family members' attorneys subpoenaed my deposition. They came out and they invoked this gag order. So there has been so many gag orders, and some of it's so ridiculous that basically they are gagging even my existence. And as you just pointed out, I provided this testimony to the Congress, to the 9/11 Commission, all tape recorded, to the Inspector General's Office, the Department of Justice. And if today you were to call the Congress and ask them, they would say it's under investigation. Well, it's been for 3.5 years. And how can it be under investigation for 3.5 years and all these gag orders, and we have not gotten to the bottom of this thing, and these criminals have not sued prosecution in this country?
Sure. And, well, what sort of criminal investigation could we expect from the FBI on this matter when they're the ones who are to be investigated?
That's exactly the problem. You know, if you're in some company or in other places and you come across these criminal activities, who would you report to? You would report it to the Department of Justice and the FBI. But what happens when you come across these criminal activities and find out through Department of Justice and the FBI and the fact that they are blocking it from being investigated, then who do you go to? And I have been asking this question, and that's why I started all these court cases 3 years ago, which is being gagged and stopped, and they are fighting it ferociously. It's just so maybe through the court system we can subpoena witnesses and bring out these documents so I can give it to the American public and say, here are these documents.
Well, you have your three branches of government to choose from. Obviously, your problem is with the executive branch in the first place. Now, you say that Congress has promised that they were going to come to bat for you, Senators Grassley and Leahy, and they never did.
No.
And so all you're left now is the courts. Have you had any success in the courts at all?
No. To this day, they are not even allowing us any hearings. They go in private, and they have these private secret conferences with the judges, and then the judges come out and say, okay, you cannot have any hearings. So we filed with the Supreme Court last week. And by mid-October, we will know whether or not the Supreme Court is going to accept the case and question the legality of these gag orders, because it's unconstitutional for the government to come and say, we don't even have to present you with any reasons why we are issuing gag orders, because the reasons themselves are classified. I mean, this is so Kafkaesque, Scott.
Well, and it's interesting that the state secrets privilege actually doesn't exist. There's no law that has ever been passed by Congress that even says such a thing. Wasn't it the Supreme Court that made up the state secrets privilege in the first place?
Yes, it's based on common law. And in fact, most judges, they don't even know how it is applied. And therefore, that's another challenge that we are bringing about, for the Supreme Court to look into this and say, this is time for us to clarify, you know, what the hell is this state secret privilege? If you were to go and ask many attorneys in the country, they would tell you, hey, I didn't know that the United States had any official secret act. And they get surprised, because even most attorneys don't know that we have this arcane, draconian common law that is being exercised to gag people and rid them from their First Amendment rights.
Well, Sabelle, let's see if we can figure out why they're going to such lengths to keep you quiet. Why don't you tell me, what is the American Turkish Council? Or actually, let me rephrase that. Can you tell me what the American Turkish Council is?
Well, sure. It's on the website. They are this organization, lobbying organization for Turkish business and relationship between the United States and Turkey. It's exactly like AIPAC.
Oh, good. Oh, exactly like AIPAC.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, they have so many crossovers. If you look at their members, you will basically see many members that basically are on both organizations. And if you look at the people who are in the management and they're in charge of this lobbying group, you come across the same names, and which is very interesting.
That is very interesting. In fact, my next guest after you will be Bob Dreyfus about the AIPAC spy scandal. And something that occurred to me last night as I read the Vanity Fair piece, An Inconvenient Patriot, about you, was that some of the things, and we'll try to get to this a little bit later, unnamed Department of Defense and Department of State employees, which made me wonder whether perhaps your case is tied in with the AIPAC spy scandal case in any way.
Absolutely, and I cannot go into any details, and maybe some other investigative journalists from across the oceans will come here and do the rest of this article as article part two. But yes, but even the AIPAC spy scandal, as far as I'm reading today, is just touching the surface of it. It's going to only to a certain degree. It doesn't go high enough in terms of what it involves and how far it goes. And that's as best as I can explain.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, and we'll see what we can make of it. Now, can I ask you how you first learned of the American Turkish Council?
Oh, no, you can't.
That's classified, huh?
No, you can't.
Okay, well, according to this article, which is written, everybody, by David Rose, it's in the current issue of Vanity Fair magazine. It's called An Inconvenient Patriot. And I'm going to go ahead, because the state secrets privilege has not been invoked against me so far, I don't think. And David Rose says in this article, he basically went and talked to the congressional staffers who have debriefed you. And what they say is that while you were translating intercepts for the FBI, you overheard American Turkish Council employees discussing criminal activity among both Republicans and Democrats, and even including the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert. Can you cough or sneeze or blink twice or anything for me?
All I can tell you is these sources that David Rose interviewed, I'm sure because the article says they were the people who were present during the investigation of the Congress and their meetings with the FBI. So I am sure it was not based on hearsay that they made these comments. I'm sure they did it based on the wiretap recordings that they heard and the documents. So they just didn't come, you know, and just say this is what it was without having all those documents and files from the FBI to go over, and I guess their statements were based on the evidence presented to them both by the Inspector General's office. Glenn Fine briefed the Congress because, as you know, the report itself, the IG report, Inspector General's report, was classified, but they briefed the Congress. So I guess they relied on the documents from the Inspector General's office and the FBI to make those statements. I guess that was the case.
Ah, so this doesn't just come from you, but from the official investigations of your accusations as well.
But that's what I would assume, because if these are congressional sources who were in this investigation, and also David Rose, the article points out that he spoke with certain FBI officials who were part of these files and case investigations within the FBI, they would not make just comments based on, okay, this is what we think it is, but they would provide facts. That's my assumption. Otherwise, Vanity Fair would not print these.
Okay, now the article quotes one unnamed official as saying, "This is the reason why Ashcroft reacted to Sabell in such an extreme fashion. It was to keep this from coming out."
When you say this, I don't know. I assume that if you go to my CBS 60 Minutes transcript from October 2002, even though they chose to mostly broadcast the administrative problems and issues, I had one statement there that said it involved people, officials, well-recognized names in the Department of State, in the Department of Defense, and certain elected officials. So I believe the source also is quoted somewhere else talking about the fact that in late 90s, they were going to have special prosecutor to cover these criminal activities and corruption, including the politicians. And this is in the article. But later, after the administration changed, they decided to cool it and not do anything with it. So they stopped the investigation. And they went against the initial decision of having special prosecutors trying and basically indicting these criminals in the Department of State and Department of Defense and the Congress.
Wow, okay. Well, before we get too far ahead of ourselves in, well, basically what was learned in those wiretaps about Dennis Hastert and other Republicans and Democrats involved with the American-Turkish Council, let's go back and discuss, as much as you can say without going to prison, the role of Malik Can Dickerson in the Intercept office where you worked at the FBI.
Well, that information is pretty much public, Scott, because there have been so many reports on Dickerson. And the fact that even the Air Force Office of Special Investigation opened this criminal investigation of Douglas Dickerson, who had access to nuclear information.
Oh, still there?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
I thought there was commercial.
Yeah. Well, we got 30 seconds. So let's go ahead and go out to break, everybody. It's the Weekend Interview Show. We're talking with FBI translator whistleblower Sabelle Edmonds. Her website and petition are available at justacitizen.com. And we'll be right back. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. Website is weekendinterviewshow.com. Also, I write for antiwar.com, as does my guest, Sabelle Edmonds. Her website is justacitizen.com, and we both encourage all of you to go to justacitizen.com and sign the petition. What exactly is the petition for, Sabelle?
The petition is demanding open public hearings and investigation by the Congress. Because, as you know, I have been providing all this information. All my hearings have been all inside these SCIFs, the secure facilities, closed doors, classified. And it's way past time for the Congress to have open public hearings and let the documents, let the witnesses speak for themselves. For 3.5 years, I've been trying to get this information out and put it out into the public domain. For 3.5 years, they have been trying to hide, cover, classify, and privilege this information. Obviously, one of these parties, either my side or that side, would be very afraid, and obviously that party is not me, because I've been wanting to make these documents and this information public. And they have been relentlessly fighting it to keep it undercover by invoking national security, state secret privilege, and classification. So by signing this petition, we can demand the Congress. Not that it's going to do much good, but we have to try. That's why people talk about eternal vigilance. That is eternal vigilance. We have to be vigilant.
And for the people out there who are always wondering, yeah, but what can I do? Well, this is what you can do. This is one concrete step you can take. Go to justacitizen.com and sign Sabelle's petition. After all, the Congress is, you know, never mind the judges in the executive branch. It's the Congress that are our representatives that are supposed to be the oversight and the check and balance on executive power. If we don't control the House of Representatives, we don't control this government at all.
Well said. And as far as the Dickerson goes, I would like to point out to one fact that hasn't been really been, you know, they haven't been talking about it that much out there. In September 2002, there were three investigations, active investigations on Dickerson. One by the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, one by Department of Justice Inspector General's Office, and the third one by the Senate Judiciary Committee. And in September 2002, while these three active investigations were taking place, Dickersons fled the country. They left their house, their cars, and they fled the country. And they were allowed to leave the country, and they haven't come back. It's been 3 years, and they haven't come back.
Well, and it's even worse than that, right? Because this guy, Douglas Dickerson, the husband, he continued to be employed by the U.S. military, right? Didn't he have a job at NATO or something?
Correct, and with access, unlimited access because of his clearance to nuclear secrets, nuclear information of the United States.
All right, well, let's get back to why that ought to concern anybody. Who is this guy Douglas Dickerson, and what do you ever have against him?
As far as I know, Douglas Dickerson was stationed in Turkey between 1992 and 1997. I don't know much about that investigation that focused on certain bribery that he accepted. And I don't know by whom, and I don't have any details on that. And then he came to U.S., and he was, even though he had this access and clearance, he was in touch with certain organizations, and that's plural again, and some of these organizations, I would call them semi-legit. And while his wife worked for, this article in Vanity Fair says she worked for 2 years for American Turkish Council, but at the same time, for those 2 years, she was also working for this organization called ATA, American Turkish Association. And again, that information is public. So she was working for these two organizations. And ATC has a lot of sub-organizations, like through ATA, ATAA, with chapters all over the United States. They have hundreds of chapters. They have it in various states and several in certain states.
And this woman, Malik Khan, when she came and got her job working at the FBI, it says in this article that on two different official pieces of paperwork, she neglected to mention the fact that she had worked for the American Turkish Council, who it turns out were at least partly the targets of the intercepts that she was overhearing and reporting on.
Well, I cannot talk about the targets. However, that's correct. Malik Khan Dickerson, in her application, did not disclose, because in order to get the top secret clearance, you have to disclose everywhere you have worked, every organization you have been a member of, and she had left every single one of those empty, blank, as if she has never worked in her life, she has never been member of any organization. Then after I reported these issues in January 2002 within the FBI, they opened one investigation, and during the questioning, she was still telling them that no, she never worked anywhere else, and this was her first job that she has held, and she has never worked for any foreign organizations or lobbying firms, and she has not been a member of any organization. So, yes, that is correct.
Interesting. So here we have this semi-legit organization, the American Turkish Council, and this woman who worked for them for years comes and gets a job at the FBI helping with the translations. And now I'm pretty sure you're not allowed to talk about this, but the Vanity Fair article goes into pretty astounding detail as to how this woman, and I think you and I have discussed this part before, how she said, you know what we ought to do instead of dividing up the intercepts randomly, I ought to get all the important ones and you ought to overhear all the stuff that doesn't matter. And then, according to this Vanity Fair article, your common boss, Mike Feghali, took her side.
Correct. There is much more on Mike Feghali. And he himself is or was under investigation both by the Inspector General's office and the Congress, because his case goes even beyond the person, which is very interesting. And he is still there in charge of Arabic translation, a division of FBI Washington Field Office.
All right, we've got to take another break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Sibel Edmonds. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton talking with Sibel Edmonds. Now, Sibel, you had a different boss at the FBI, I guess the guy who was the customer of your information, a guy named David Satcher, right?
Dennis Satcher.
Oh, Dennis. My mistake. Now, who exactly was he? And I guess in this article it says he sort of took your side against Mike Feghali and Malik Khan Dickerson, right?
Well, correct. In the FBI, at least for the language division, You have two supervisors. One would be the administrative supervisors who actually have no control over or supervision over your actual work and investigation. They just take care of your hours and your schedule, et cetera, which was Mike Feghali. He was not an agent. Then the agent who was in charge of the main department of language that I was working for, because I did work for several languages, Farsi, Turkish, and Azerbaijani. But for the Turkish division, it was Dennis Satcher, Special Agent Satcher.
Okay, now, he expressed concern to you, according to this article, that perhaps there was some espionage going on there on the part of Malik Khan Dickerson. I'm curious, was that before or after Malik Khan and her husband had come to your house and tried to recruit you and your husband?
Well, it was around the same time, and in fact, before before even I found out about it, he was reporting it to the FBI headquarters and his bosses, the supervisory special agents, about suspicious activities by Dickerson in terms of certain wiretap information that were being blocked and the documents that she was forging signatures on and various other cases that he had come across. And this was even before I was I started reporting the issues to the FBI management.
Well, then when he found out about the new arrangement where Malik Khan Dickerson was assigned all the important stuff and you were assigned all the unimportant stuff, he had you go back and retranslate and take a look at some of the things that she had marked as not pertinent, right?
Correct. He asked me and another language specialist to go and to go over all those pieces of communications that were stamped as not pertinent to be translated by Dickerson, and some of them were really long, conversation pieces. But to go back and translate them and find out whether or not the information there was pertinent or not.
And did you find that she had mostly been correct in marking things not pertinent?
No, just the opposite. Just through our first batch, the first 10, 12 communication that was blocked, we came across extremely important, pertinent information that had to do with illegal activities between certain foreign elements and certain agencies in the United States.
And when you reported this to your superiors, you are the one who got punished.
Initially, actually, they came and they wanted to give me a raise and promotion for, in return, they asked me to just leave it alone and not to report it further up to the headquarters. And that's how it worked, within the FBI's language division. There were things like that happening all the time. And, after I insisted that this, needed to be investigated and went higher up, they started, threatening me and retaliating against me. They busted my home and confiscated my home computer, my husband's home computer, and they forced me to take a polygraph, and then later they fired.
And also it says in the Vanity Fair article that Malik Khan Dickerson herself actually threatened you.
Correct. That occurred in January 2002.
And if I remember correctly, the quote was something to the effect of, why are you doing this? You could be getting your family back in Turkey in danger.
Correct.
And did anything ever come of this threat?
Well, yes. I really don't feel like going through that because that's really hard for me to speak about because my family's life had changed. They had to come to the U.S. They had to apply for political asylum. In fact, the Congress helped them to apply for political asylum based on documents they received from Turkey that had various threats in it. But that is not the point that I really want to make as far as the country goes. And that's why I usually tell people I don't think the issue here is about whistleblowing, being fired, being wronged. That is not the most important issue here. The most important issue is what were these criminal activities and why instead of pursuing these, our government chooses to cover it up and actually issue classification and gag orders so the American public won't know about what's going on within their agencies and within their government, even within their Congress. And that is the focus point. And I have been trying, what I have written to the state and with my interviews, to steer away from the fact that, yes, I was fired, yes, I was wronged, and they retaliated against me and how they ruined my life, which is all true. But this is not where I want to focus, and this is not where I want the country to focus. This is not where I want the Congress to focus. I'm not saying, look, they did wrong to me, and this is not fair. I'm saying I came forward because criminal activities are taking place, have been taking place, some of them since 1997. Some of these activities are 100% related to the 9/11 terrorist attack in the United States, and they are giving this illusion that they are pursuing these cases, but they are not. If the cases touches upon certain countries or certain high-level people, certain sensitive relations, then they don't. But on the other hand, they go and they talk about the lower-level criminal activities that boils down to people like Atta and Hamdi.
Right. Well, so let's get into that criminal activity then. The semi-legit organization that I think you most often are referring to here, I believe I can deduce, is the American Turkish Council, which is headed by Brent Scowcroft, the former National Security Advisor of the United States, and is packed with the leaders of Raytheon, Motorola, Boeing, Lockheed Martin Marietta, and some of the most powerful company names in the military-industrial complex.
Correct.
Is the ATC just one of many semi-legitimate organizations that you're referring to, or is most of this story focused on the ATC itself?
It's one of many. There are many organizations.
And many organizations that you actually were overhearing.
I cannot talk to you about what I was overhearing, but as I have pointed out, there are several organizations.
Okay, and you mentioned, when you talk about criminal activity, drug running, money laundering, weapon smuggling.
And these activities overlap. It's not like, okay, you have certain criminal entities who are active in nuclear black market, and then you have certain criminal activities who are bringing the narcotics from the east. You have the same players. When you look into these activities at high level, you come across the same players. They are the same people.
Well, when we're talking about those kind of levels of liquid cash money, we probably also have to include major banks too, right?
Financial institutions, yes.
Did you learn of anything which implicated Brent Scowcroft or the leadership of the ATC in this corruption?
As I said, I do not talk about this information, and Vanity Fair has gotten through various sources, official sources, the information about the ATC, and they have written an article about it, but I do not talk about targets.
I understand. And David Rose, in fact, did write in the Vanity Fair article that there wasn't anything that he knows of that you found that directly implicated Brent Scowcroft.
But again, depends on who was the source and the sources and the information that particular source provided, but I can't confirm or not confirm it.
I see. But I want to get a promise out of you that when they finally lift this gag order, that I get to interview you first. I got a long list of questions that I can't ask.
Sure, and believe me, once that is lifted, the state secret privilege, and once the court case actually begins and we have the witnesses and we can subpoena documents, it will be public. And it will be major. And it would make the AIPAC case look lame, actually.
Oh. It will make the AIPAC case look lame.
Correct.
Oh, boy, I can't wait. Well, let me go ahead and share with the people some things that I know you're not allowed to talk about but are in the Vanity Fair article. And, by the way, for anybody just tuning in, it's in the current issue of Vanity Fair, an article called An Inconvenient Patriot about my guest, Sabelle Edmonds. It's by a guy named David Rose, who I believe writes for the London Guardian mostly. Now, he talked to the debriefers from the different agencies and bodies, from the FBI, the congressional investigators, and I believe also the September 11th commissioners, too. And they shared with him some very interesting allegations that Sabelle is not allowed to talk about, or she'll go to prison. Most importantly, that Dennis Hastert, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, at least is implicated in cooperating on some very important issues with the ATC, and that one of the phone calls overheard, at least, was some ATC officials bragging that they bought the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert, for $500,000. They gave him $500,000 in order to change his vote on an Armenian genocide resolution. I think we all know about the genocide of the Armenians by the Turks in the 19-teens, and various states around the world have passed resolutions condemning that, and the Americans were about to pass a resolution. In fact, there's a pretty substantial Armenian population in California, and the press at the time that all this was happening pointed out that it was pretty obvious that the reason that Dennis Hastert was pushing for this condemnation of Turkey for the genocide of the Armenians was in order to help some Republicans in California get reelected. But then at the last minute, he changed his mind and withdrew the resolution. Right as a major helicopter deal was going through, this resolution that would have made Turkey look really bad. And according to David Rose in Vanity Fair, Dennis Hastert got paid $500,000 to change his position on that. Am I going off the story anywhere there, Sabelle? Can you comment either way?
No, but as I said, the reason I went to the Congress and to the 9/11 Commission had to do with criminal activities, and the criminal activities that I provided information had a lot to do with 9/11. And it's very interesting, for example, this latest development with the 9/11 Commission and this information from Department of Defense that had to do with ATA, right?
Right, Able Danger.
Yeah, and the main media here is treating it as if, oh, here is one piece of information that the 9/11 Commission didn't include. I had this press conference last summer, and together with 25 national security experts, these are the people from NSA, CIA, FBI, and we provided the public during this press conference with a list of witnesses who provided direct information. Some of them had to do with the finance of Al-Qaeda, and these are people from FBI, NSA, CIA, to the 9/11 Commission. And the 9/11 Commission omitted all this information, even though some of this information had been established as facts. One of them has to do with certain informants in April 2001, and this informant provided very specific information about the attack. The other had to do with certain information that the FBI had in July and August 2001, where blueprints and the building composites of certain skyscrapers were being sent to certain Middle Eastern countries, and many more information that were just omitted. With my case, they just said refer to the Inspector General's report, even though I have provided the commissioners with the documents and names of witnesses. So now, today, you're seeing the press talking about, one piece, which right now the commission is denying, saying, well, we don't recall receiving that information. Well, I can put out 20 other cases, and these are from agents who worked for agencies such as FBI, CIA, some of them for 20 years, some of them for 18 years. And I have their list, I have their affidavits that they provided documents and information, they were all omitted. But the media is treating it, there was this one piece of information that was omitted from the 9/11 commissioner's report.
And as you pointed out, some of this information has been confirmed in the public. I know when you speak of the Iranian informant who warned in April of 2001, that was even confirmed by Mueller, the director of the FBI.
Absolutely. And there was actually an article in Chicago Tribune in July 2004 saying that even Mueller expressed surprise that during the hearings, the 9/11 commissioner didn't ask about this. And guess what? Nobody reported on all the submission. And now suddenly they're putting this and the commissioner saying, we don't recall. Well, what would happen if you hit them with 20 cases? And I'm talking about 20 affidavits from experts and veteran agents.
And this is all basically around the question of prior knowledge and who knew what when before the attack.
And also what happens afterwards. And I started working 3 days after September 11th with a lot of documents and wiretaps that I was translating. They some of them dated back to 1997, 1998. So even after September 11th, covering up these investigations and not pursuing some of these investigations because the Department of State says, you know what, you can't pursue this because that may deal with this particular country. If these countries that these investigations deal with are not one of the axis of evils, we don't want to pursue them. I mean, that American people have the right to know this. I mean, this is just they're giving this grand illusion as if there are some investigations, but they are not. You know, they're coming down on these charities as the financing of Al-Qaeda. Well, if you were to talk about financing of Al-Qaeda, very small percentage comes from these charity foundations. Vast majority of their financing comes from narcotics. Look, we had 4 to 6% of the narcotics drugs in the U.S. coming from the East, coming from Pakistan and Afghanistan via the Balkans to the United States. Today, four years after September 11th, that has reached over 15%. How is it getting here? Who are getting the proceeds from this narcotics?
Perhaps the same people who make it illegal to drive up the price? Maybe. Maybe not. I don't know. Now, listen, when you talk about the State Department and sensitive diplomatic ties with foreign countries that they would prefer not be stepped on, I'm sorry, but the word Israel is just screaming on the inside of my head here. I guess you can't give me any indication, yes or no, whether that's what you're talking about.
Well, what is interesting? Vanity Fair article, I don't know how many people picked up on that, but they're saying Turkish countries. It's a plural, people. And to look at, say, okay, if you're looking at this region of the world that nobody is referring to the war against terror, okay, you're looking at Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. And these are the countries that now we are busy establishing base in. And the large portion of their GDP depends on narcotics, and there's huge presence, Al-Qaeda presence in those countries. We don't hear anything about Balkan countries. And again, their direct ties and their direct relevance to Al-Qaeda, they are not even naming these countries. The role that Pakistan played before and the role that Pakistan is playing today. So, as I have said before, there are several countries, there are several organizations, and we cannot just say, you know, isolate one country or one organization.
All right, everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back after this break to wrap up with Sibel Edmonds. Her website is justacitizen.com. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Sibel Edmonds. Her website is justacitizen.com, and you can read what she writes at antiwar.com/Edmonds. Now, we've only got a few minutes left here, but I want to get to your appearance on Democracy Now! Earlier in the week. In referring to officials at the State Department, you used the word treason, and I wonder whether this is specifically referring to the September 11th attacks, and whether you have information that indicates complicity on the part of American elites who are part of these semi-legit organizations that funded September 11th, or are we talking 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon here?
Again, it's hard to talk about this around the gag order. But this is what I have been saying for past 3 years. That's why I refer to the transcript of CBS 60 Minutes. These people who call themselves Americans, and these people who are using their position, their official position, within these agencies, some of them in the Department of Defense and some of them in the Department of State. And yet what they are doing is, with their position and with their influence, it's against the United States national security. It's against the best interests of its people. And that is treason. Be it giving information to those that are either quasi-allies, but I would underline quasi, because you hear the administration talking about evils and acts of evils and enemies, and I'm referring to quasi-allies, who one day will be another Al-Qaeda, and who are already engaged in activities that are damaging to our country, its security and its interests. And that is treason.
If I that name... Is, oh, go ahead.
Sure, go ahead.
No, please finish.
So that's what I was referring to. And what would you call someone who, let's say if they were to go after Douglas Fight, okay? And if they were to establish that Douglas Fight, with his access to information, willingly, intentionally, use his position, use the information he had, and gave it to those that would one day use it, or maybe right now are using that information against the United States, would you call that treason?
Well, if it's an overt act to benefit an American enemy, then yep, that's treason.
Correct. And as I said, those lines are so blurry because there are certain countries that we call allies, but I wouldn't call them allies. So these countries are quasi-allies.
Okay, now I'm going to go ahead and name some people who I suspect inside the State Department and the Pentagon, and I suppose you won't be able to answer affirmative or negative on any of these. But I'm very curious. When I read about this kind of corruption going on in the State Department, I immediately think, well, and particularly in the first term, I immediately think of John Bolton and David Woomser. Do those names mean anything to you?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to answer that question at all. But you also should pay attention to the fact that some of these people have been there for a while. And some of those people have had their roots in there even in mid-1990s.
So more career officials rather than political appointees.
Or maybe a mixture of both.
Maybe a mixture of both. Thank you very much for your time today, Sibel.
Thank you, Scott.
I sure wish they'd let you talk.
Well, maybe one day.
Okay. Take good care, everybody. We're going to be right back talking with Bob Dreyfus all about the Israeli spies in the Pentagon. Stay tuned.